What's different about me is I never like say I was going to be a politician, right? I didn't spend the last 10, 20 years of my life working in Minneapolis because one day I was going to run for office. I worked very low wage jobs, probably made about $35,000 a year. Most of the jobs I worked in Minneapolis public schools. I seen the problems that existed for folks who were low wage workers and watched them overcome some of those problems. But I'm also a kid from the streets of Milwaukee. And so some of the stuff that, you know, our young folks are dealing with, I dealt with them.
Right now.
Have you had any hilarious campaign interactions yet?
that I want to talk about. Like, it's just, it's really more about people who are so polar. They have just like super polar opposite, diverse opinions on one subject and then another subject. They're like, oh no. So just that, like somebody might be super progressive on like environmental issues, wanting to close the hurt down, you know, super progressive issues right. that are common for this area. But then they're like, I don't want the folks in encampment. So it's like, oh, okay. I thought, you know, so it's just those really diverse swings of political opinions it's kind of makes me chuckle a little bit. But you know, I think that if folks are under that the same tent, I think they're winnable. They're not, you know, they believe that the environment is good. They believe folks deserve a good shot in life. You know, I think those folks are winnable. It's the ones who, you know, like just they have this staunch dogma about, you know, their politics and they don't want to change for nothing. So right. I think every voice is winnable.
You were first elected to the park board in 2017. Is that right?
Sounds about right. The year after Donald Trump was elected president.
Okay. And does it feel like you talk about how the atmosphere is now and people are a little polarized and does the atmosphere feel different to you now?
You know, I'm going to be honest. I detached myself from like city, like the local politics a little bit, kind of dug myself into work. I was thinking about running for this seat. I was wondering what Hodan was going to, you know, Representative Hodan was going to do. So, I think the politics after the last city election was pretty divisive. The turnover for the city council, it's divisive. I think we're divisive depending on what part of the city you're living in, and you know how you see our folks who are unhoused, like what end of the fence you're in on that. So,
yeah. Okay, we're ready to begin. This is the Wedge Live podcast. I'm your host, John Edwards. My guest today is our second interview with a candidate for District 62B in the Minnesota House of Representatives, Londell French, former Minneapolis Park Board Commissioner. Welcome.
How you doing, John? Appreciate it. Thanks for having me here.
Pretty good. Thanks for getting home from work and immediately coming on a podcast.
Yeah, no problem.
Let's remind people at the top, the DFL 62, Senate District 62 convention is April 14th, gotcha. Where they will be trying to endorse at least a candidate in 62B.
I hope it's me.
I'm trying to recreate these interviews roughly the same for each candidate, with a little diversion here and there. We always start with transportation. So give me your transportation vision and what you would hope to accomplish if you're elected.
Well, transportation is, I grew up, my grandma raised me from probably the age of 11 and my grandma never had a car. So on the weekends, you know, she would, even when I wasn't living with her, she would come grab me and we'd go take a trip on a bus somewhere and I would get some McDonald's or some, you know, some fast food, you know, ice cream or something. But I was really like the mule that she used to kind of carry all the bags and stuff. But I learned our bus system really well in, you know, where I'm from. I learned how to ride a bus at 11, 12 years old. It was a big part of me growing up. And my grandma always talked about, you know, wherever you moved at, even if you have a car, you make sure you live, you know, somewhere close to a bus in case your car breaks and you can still have a way to get to work. That was always instilled in me, that public transportation was something that, you know, everybody could use. And it was a tool that I don't think everybody, you know, really use it like they can use it or they should use it. But with that being said, I believe that, I think there's less than like 40% of the income, 40% of the revenue generated from fares and fees of the bus actually go to the operation of the bus. I figure we can figure out a way at the legislature to, I don't know, we can make that fee go away for folks and make buses free for everyone. I think that'd be a really great idea. I remember being really, really poor. I was working in our Minneapolis public schools and I didn't make a lot of money. And I caught the bus. The first 4 years I lived in Minnesota, you know, I caught the bus. And I remember scraping up pennies and quarters, you know, to get on the bus to go to work the next day. I can imagine what did that look like if we took that away from folks and they can get up and go to work and save, you know, 30, 40 bucks a week. You know, that means a lot to some folks. It might not mean a lot to other people, but 30, 40 bucks means that's another couple of meals for you and your family. So that would be great if we can make it so anybody can just walk on a bus and get where they need to go, whether it be a job or just go out and have some fun.
It seems like the public safety, the tool they're using at Metro Transit and the Met Council is we're going to check fares. That's how we're going to ensure that transit is safe. It sounds like you want to go in an opposite direction. Can you talk about, like, do you think the current approach? Because it seems like the way they're trying to make trains and buses safe, we're gonna check fares. We're gonna get people who haven't paid their fare off the train, and that is part of their public safety platform. What do you think about that?
I think we're missing some more of the stuff in that conversation. I think that we have unhoused folks who are using the trains as shelter, and I think if we figure that issue out, which there's ways and there's examples of successes in that area. I think those are two different issues. I think the traditional way is, you know, that's their job right now because that's how folks pay to get on the bus right now or the trains. So I think that they're just doing what they're told to do. And that's the model that's being used right now. But I think, you know, when you're a legislator, you get a chance to make the laws. If the laws change and, you know, the fee system changes, then I think that, we don't have to worry about that. We'll put those resources into other things. So I think that's just the traditional way we've been doing things. I think people can be retaught to think differently.
So what is your favorite bus route? You talked about taking the bus as a kid. Was that in Minneapolis? Did you grow up somewhere else?
I'm from Milwaukee, Wisconsin originally. I moved up here in 1998. Best thing I ever did in my life. My favorite bus route here, I would have to say I want to say it was a 19, I think. It's the one that runs down Cedar.
Okay.
I think that's the one. But that one, because I didn't have any money. I didn't know anybody when I first moved up here. And I would get on that bus and put my headphones on. And I remember riding that bus from one end of the city to the other end of the city. That was my entertainment. Like, just ride and got to see people and got to see the city. And I remember coming up towards around Lake Nokomis, which was, you know, I was like, wow, the lake right in the middle of the city. That's crazy. And, you know, just exploring the city. And it was just a great way for me to learn the city. But also, I would catch the 180 bus. They used to stop on top of the highway, 35W. Caught that bus to get back and forth to different parts of the town. Just going downtown, catching the number 22 bus. So I think that goes down Cedar for a minute, but the 9 was a bus I caught for a while because I lived off 4th Street in the Central Neighborhood. So that bus was, I don't know the buses that I've been, you know, I catch the bus every now and again to go downtown because I refuse to pay all that money for parking. Right. But I don't catch it as much as I should.
So you mentioned on your website, I'm going to read from your website. One of the things you support is the I-94 Boulevard conversion to reduce emissions while also beginning to undo the devastating impact highway construction had on Twin Cities Black communities. Can you talk about how you came to support that and why you think that's a good idea?
Well, a lot of it has to do with where I'm from. I'm from Milwaukee, and I think there's an episode of this in almost every city in America where when the national highway system was you know, put up for. I think a lot of cities looked at it as a way to get rid of certain areas and certain people and deal with quote unquote problems that were happening in those areas. And in Milwaukee, we had a place called Brownsville. It was a place where, you know, my grandma, I never knew this place, never seen it. You know, I just heard about it from endless stories from my grandmother, right? Just always talking about Walnut Street. And maybe she knew, you know, I would be in a position to, you know, save some things that were precious and to certain folks. But she talked about that place with great reverence. And I know when folks talk about some of the places they talk about here in Minneapolis, it's that same kind of talk, right? And so I want to support, you know, the folks who have, you know, lost a lot and make sure that the future generations can enjoy some of those, that sense of community. Cause that's what I heard when people talk like places like Rondo. I hear a community that was lost, and who knows what could have come from those communities if we haven't lost such, you know, precious places.
Environmental justice. This is another quote from your website. Closing major polluters like Smith Foundry and the HERC incinerator. So how do you go, what's the mechanism if you get elected to the legislature, how do you go about making sure that happens?
Well, we have to figure out what we're going to do with the trash once we close it down. I think we have to have a lot of voices to that, bring a lot of voices to that table. There's a lot of different parts of the city and the counties who have a lot of say so on that. It's a really difficult issue, but I think burning our trash and having most of the air going to the folks in North Minneapolis where it's affecting, you know, rates of asthma are really, really high. Figuring out what we do with our trash is very, very important. What we're doing with it right now is not working. It's going to be a tough talk. It's going to be a hard conversation with some people. And we're going to have to tell people, hey, you don't get what you want. We have to figure out a different way to do this because it's hurting a lot of people.
Let's talk about leadership. Can you think of a time, give me an example from the relatively recent past. You saw a problem in the community and you showed up and you tried to solve it.
Oh yeah, yeah. This is one of my favorite stories. It was during COVID and everything was shutting down, and you know we were doing all this. You know, we're doing stuff. We're opening up the parkways, you know, for no travel, and we were spending a lot of money doing stuff for a lot of different other, you know, parts of the city to make sure folks had space to exercise. And I was like, we don't really do a lot for folks in the inner city, and you know, and I got a lot of phone calls about kids, you know, playing basketball. It was like, oh my God, kids are playing basketball. They're congregating. And I was like, well, we're not, you know, what resources are we putting forth so, you know, that we are, you know, these kids aren't congregating? The answer was not really much. So later on during COVID, once things got kind of loose a little bit, still, things were still shut down. But, you know, North Commons had a water park, and It's a great water park. But we only probably had about 50, 60 kids who were in that park every day. And the capacity for that park was about 250. It costs about $300,000 a year to actually operate the park. I think we only took in about $50,000 or $55,000 a year in fees, and, you know, swim classes and stuff like that. So it didn't make sense to charge folks. And if we're not, you know, then we're not, you know, If we're charging folks and that's keeping them from using it at a time where folks really need something to do, right? I'm thinking about a mother who has four or five kids, you know, and it's $5 to go to this park. You know, they may not can go but once a month, maybe twice a month. But if you took those fees away, you'd have more people using it. And that's exactly what happened. We went from 50 kids a day to about 150, 200 kids every day using that pool, and it's an amenity for everybody. So if we had a opportunity to make more, you know, reduce more barriers to joy like that was something, you know, a lot of folks were like, why don't we just make it, you know, free for folks who can't afford it? And I was like, well, then we're putting those kids on the spotlight. Hey, you know what? Let's just, it's we own it. I lived at the pool as a kid. So making a pool free, I mean, maybe it was a childhood dream of mine to just making, you know, it free or what, I don't know, but it was a great decision to be able to lead the community, and a lot of response from mothers who didn't have anything to do, you know, had stuff to do with their kids. They, oh, we go to the pool 2-3 times a week now. That to me was awesome. So that's that was awesome.
Are you ready for a hard question? A really hard question?
Nope. Yeah, sure.
Education. So define the problem for public schools and how you would use your role at the legislature to strengthen public schools in Minneapolis.
I think the big issue is we've chronically underfunded our school systems probably for the last 20 years. Our last session was the first time our schools were fully funded to the point where our educators were, this is what our educators asked for, and they got what they wanted, you know? And so I think if we can do that consistently, you know, for more than just one legislative cycle, we have to also look at our charter schools that are tearing away our families from public schools. Our public schools can't compete with charter schools because our charter schools can refuse kids that public schools can't. And as somebody who worked at our schools, I worked in special ed classes for almost 20 years. There's some kids who have, you know, severe cognitive and physical disabilities that the charter school just won't handle. And so there's other costs that come with, you know, working with kids like that. There's other resources that are needed. You know, that kid may need to get picked up in the morning every day. So that's, you know, now they need a bus ride, they need an aid. So the public schools, we have to ingest all those costs, and we're supposed to get, you know, reimbursed by the federal government, but that doesn't always happen. And so the public schools are always, you know, set, you know, they're picking up all the bills for the folks who have no other choice but to come to our schools. And that's okay. But if that's going to happen, I think we need to put some checks on the charter schools and say, hey, you have to, you know, do the same thing that the public schools are doing. But I really think we need to double down and invest in our public schools to make them the best that we can. I'm a student of public schools. I think most of the folks who are involved in like civic activities, they're public school graduates and public school students. So I don't know. I think that's a system that we have. I think we need to improve on it and make it better.
Have you been watching this Uber and Lyft debate, the back and forth?
Yeah.
It seems like Uber and Lyft want the legislature to step in and preempt the city. I don't know if the DFL legislature is willing to do that necessarily. City Council is talking about working with the legislature to adjust it, maybe, depending on to look at the study that the state did. Do you have a take on that? What do you think of all of that?
Well, I do consider myself pretty much a labor guy, so I feel like you have a group of workers who feel like they're not being paid justly. And I'm seeing how much, you know, what's Uber and Lyft actually doing, but providing an app. I mean, I know that's probably, you know, some overhead on that, but if you're not being paid fairly, I think you have a right to say, hey, we're not being paid fairly. I don't think that the legislature should get involved if the city decides that, look, this is what we want. I'm pretty sure there's somebody going to come in and fill that void with Uber and Lyft if they decide to leave. I think Uber and Lyft know that. I think there's probably five or six other app companies that will come in and take care of that. And so I don't think we're going to lose that from the city. I really believe that the city council kind of has spoken. And yeah, I think we allow that, a lot of the cities to figure that out.
I don't think they're going to leave. They're threatening to leave. I don't think they want to risk leaving and having some other thing step in and potentially be successful. It seems like a huge risk to them.
Yeah, and then the place they become successful here, they may gravitate to other cities. So it's, yeah, they don't want to. I don't know if they want to lose that market share. So, but the only thing I was really, you know, apprehensive about, like, I consider myself kind of a disability advocate. So I was really worried about folks who had disabilities, you know, getting around the city, getting to their doctor's appointment, but. From what I'm looking at, there's two or three other companies that are ready to come and fill that void. So that's kind of been doused out of my
concerns. Yeah. Do you support the bill currently being debated at the state legislature that would fix the Minnesota Environmental Rights Act so it can't be used against municipal comprehensive plans like the 2040 plan and other cities who would like to add more housing in their comprehensive plans?
I want to, so this is a touchy subject, but I think we need more housing, but I really want to make sure that we're respecting the rights of certain municipalities. But I don't want these certain cities using these zoning laws to keep certain people out of, you know, certain areas. And I think, you know, traditionally that's what a lot of zoning laws have done, keep folks out, whether, you know, certain economic groups or certain racial groups or whatever. And so, it's a very touchy subject, but I want to make sure that we also are giving kudos to that the folks on the ground in that certain municipality know what they're talking about and, you know, give them the benefit of the doubt. But I also want to make sure there's some type of check to make sure that we're not keeping folks out of the community that they want to be in, but they can't because they can't afford to live there, or they just don't, you know, their kind isn't welcome.
So when you say respect municipalities, I think like the League of Minnesota Cities is for this fix.
Yeah.
This would just let cities do with their comprehensive plans what they want to do.
What I'm thinking is like there may be some other cities who maybe want to do something else, but right. But when legislators always, you know, get involved with stuff, but they, you know, I think we should sit back and wait for the problem, not the problem to exist, but I don't know. There's been some cases in history where people who look like me weren't allowed to live in places, and they've used zoning laws to do that. So I just want to make sure that there's some type of safety valve to make sure that's not being used in either way. Cause sometimes folks who do that work are pretty crafty about making sure certain folks aren't living in your neighborhood.
Right. There's a missing middle bill. This is a different bill the legislature has taken up to basically legalize duplexes and fourplexes and provide bonuses for density bonuses for affordability and sustainable building practices. Is that something you'd like to see?
Yes, but I want to try to make that primarily through like transit corridors.
Okay.
So we want to, you know, make sure we're trying to reduce the amount of cars that are, you know, so mostly, yeah, during transit corridors, I believe there should be a lot of density.
Parking minimums is another bill they're potentially going. I don't know how alive this one is anymore. I haven't been tracking it, but reducing parking minimums.
Yeah, we should have done it a long time ago. I think we were so tied to our cars here in the city, just in America, period, that we automatically got to, you know, make sure we got to have a place for a car. I think if that's stopping us from building affordable housing to make sure we have a spot for a car, I think we can do away with that really, really quickly.
And another bill, traffic enforcement cameras for stuff like speeding and red light running. You think that's a good idea?
I do not. I'd really like to see more information, more studies done to see how that affects folks of color and where they're putting them at. Okay. Yeah, I think they're a revenue grab for a lot of municipalities. I don't know if there's evidence that they actually make the streets safer, but they do make the cities a lot of money.
Revitalizing Lake Street. So what do you think are the state policy levers you could push to reinvigorate commercial areas like Lake Street?
Funding. We have to make sure that, you know, funding is available for small business owners. We have to make sure that folks who want to do projects in the community, maybe want to build a community center and have young folks gather there. Like, let's look for like small projects, do like some micro grants to folks who really want to get some stuff done, but just don't have the resources to do it. I think the biggest thing that folks need are resources to get the projects there. I hear a lot of great ideas from folks when I'm talking to people, and they just don't have the money, resources, or the know-how. So maybe try to provide some type of clearinghouse where you can find all that information, and maybe folks that can walk you through the process of actually, you know, getting some funds for whatever project you're working on.
So in this era where the city points at the county, and there's a lot of finger-pointing when it comes to homelessness, what would be your role at the legislature to help the city and or county address encampments?
I think there's so many issues when we talk about folks who are unhoused. There's so many issues that if those other issues were dealt with, I think the population of our unhoused folks would go down a lot. Back in the 80s when Reagan, you know, he eliminated, you know, he closed down all our institutions that dealt with folks who had mental health issues. Because they were horrible. He closed them because they were horrible. Not to give Reagan any credit or anything, but they were pretty bad places. And so he closed them. But there was no replacement for them. There was nothing else that came upon it. And so our folks who were dealing with mental health ended up on our streets. They ended up in our prisons or the hospital. So those were the places where our mentally ill ended up at. And so that's a huge group of folks who are on the streets right now, are folks who are dealing with mental health issues. And so I think we figure that out. I think folks who are dealing with chemical or substance abuse issues, also another group, another population that are huge population on our streets. I think asking folks to get clean, to get a house is my brain doesn't rationalize. If you're trying to, you know, do something as hard as, you know, fighting an addiction, being out somewhere where you're not safe, you don't feel safe, or you're not warm, you're not place where you can, you know, people are caring about you. That's not the place to get clean. So I really want to support a housing first model. Because in Minnesota, we've decided that veterans can't be homeless. We've decided we're going to have all these programs that wrap around veterans, and we've all in purposes ended veteran homelessness in the state of Minnesota. We have to look at every person that's on the street as a precious soul and with compassion, like we looked at our veterans. I'm not saying, our veterans deserve to have homes, but I think everybody deserves to be someplace who wants it, right? And so let's figure out how to get folks in homes, and then we'll deal with their issues, whether it be substance abuse or mental health issues after that. But let's have supportive, permanent supportive housing. I think the key is support, right? You can't have folks... I mean, I think it's hard for folks to have be on the streets 5 and 6 years, and then you put them in an apartment. And you think, oh, okay, you're good. You should be okay. No, they're going to wind up, being on the street again, or if they're not getting those supports that they need. And back to the whole idea of requiring folks to be sober to get housing. I've been dealing with my weight all my life, and I've done pretty good in the last few years ago. But if you tie my house and my living to whether I ate less than 1,500 calories a day. I'm going to do good most of those days, but I'm going to come home on a bad day and I'm on a steak and I lose my house. That's right. How I look at some of these folks who are dealing with. They're dealing with an addiction, and addictions aren't, and you can put all whatever type of morality folk want to do on folks, but this is a health issue. I grew up during the crack epidemic, and I knew how they treated folks then. They just locked folks up. And so we have a second chance to do this differently. We have a chance to make sure that folks aren't dying on the streets, because that's what's happening. I think we had something like 900 overdoses. Let's put folks in places where we have healthcare, medical care that can, sit there and be supportive if something happens, because it's going to happen. So let's just, it's a reimagining. And I also think that St. Paul and Minneapolis, kind of take a bigger part of that burden of dealing with folks who are unhoused, because we're the metro, right? And so if you're unhoused in Elk River, or you're unhoused in Detroit Lakes somewhere, the resources just aren't there. If you were here in Minneapolis or St. Paul, or even Rochester and St. Cloud, even to a degree, those cities are having larger degrees of homelessness. Folks, not having a place to go. So I think we have to look at it more of a state issue, right? We have to make sure that if we have a huge number of unhoused folks in this area, we need to, throw resources at it. Make sure, not get caught up on what got folks on the streets. Let's just get folks off the streets and be supportive once they get a house.
Let's look into the future. Let's imagine Londell French has finished his 20th year, 10 terms in the Minnesota House. Can you believe it? what issue will people think of when they think of you? The issue, your signature issue. What will they think of?
I got two that are really, really big. So there's a gap of services for our 18 to 25 year olds in the city. It seems like once kids turn 18, if they're not going out to college, if their families don't have that support system for them, they're kind of lost in the streets. And our society kind of treats them like adults. And, legally they are adults. But I don't know if you can remember the capacity, your cognitive capacity at the age of 21. I'm pretty sure you weren't making all the – maybe you're different. I'm sorry. Maybe you were making all the best choices. But I don't think – some of our folks, some of these young folks aren't making the best choices. And so we need to figure out how to wrap other elders from the community around those folks. There's tons of apprenticeship programs that exist in our city that aren't being taken advantage of. I went to the Carpenters Hall a couple Thursdays ago, and it was empty. And I'm like, man, I know so many guys who are always asking about jobs, and they can't find enough people to fill the job that they have. And so we need to figure out how to connect our 18 to 25 year olds, where a lot of the violence and the crime that's so-called happening in our city. I think we can connect those folks with a nice paying job that keeps a lot of folks off the streets and doing dumb stuff. I'm sorry. If you have money in your pocket, not to be rich, But if you don't fall prey to some of those temptations, folks who aren't secure in their finances, I'm safer if you have the resources that you need to pay for your housing, to pay for your food. I'm safer. I think the society's safer and our community's safer. So I really would like to double down and create some generational programming for our 18 to 25 year olds, because I think they're especially your 18 to 25 year olds of color.
Are you making phone calls to delegates right now? Is that like taking up a lot of your time?
Yeah, soon after this, I'm making calls tonight.
Are they asking you about public safety?
Public safety and unhoused neighbors are our biggest, my two biggest things right now. And that public safety one is kind of all over the place.
So what are people asking you about public safety, and like what are you telling them?
Well, public safety, as a black man who's been impacted by the criminal justice system, you know, several times, and I grew up in a place, the 53206 zip code in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, which is the most highly incarcerated zip code in the country, for a time. Most young men, before the age of 36, like 46% of the young men in that area have been impacted by, the criminal justice system somehow, whether going to jail or arrest somehow. There is a there's a fine line between safety and making sure that everybody's safe. So if safety means just making sure that white folks feel comfortable, that's and the black folks are going to jail because the laws don't reflect everybody in the community, then we have to rethink some of that. I think the police in Minneapolis, that the job of protecting people in Minneapolis, and they have a lot of issues that they have to deal with. I think we need to deal with police matters differently. I think when folks are having the worst time of their life, which is a lot of times when the cops are called, somebody are having, like, that's probably the worst day of their life, or at least worst day of their year. Sometimes a cop isn't the person that needs to show up. So I think we invest more in our folks who are more attained to, like, you know, de-escalating, right? Folks who can deal with trauma, right? If my neighbor, he you know, wilds out every 3 weeks, whatever reason, he has a you know, we call the police, whatever, he comes over and there's an incident, maybe he goes to jail, whatever. Well, what about if the community just knows that's John Doe such and such, and he's wilding out again. Let's call such and such from the city who comes and deals with him every 3 weeks. We're not going to take him to jail if he hasn't done anything. But yeah, he's calling the service. Let's figure out how to get folks connected to the, you know, help that they need. We don't also always have to call the cops out to places, because that's when folks like me want to go into jail all the time. Because if you don't know who I am, and if I'm having the worst day of my life, there's some miscommunications that can go on and somebody can get hurt. And so I think we just need to, you know, figure out different ways of police, because the way we have done it in the past has not been working. So, but I want to make sure that I don't want to, like, dismiss folks when they say that, you know, they don't feel safe. I think safety is really big. I want to feel safe. I want everybody to feel safe. So I don't want to dismiss that, but I think there's ways to do it. I think there's ways to do it without, you know, violating folks' rights or disproportionately incarcerating black and brown folks.
I'm going to read something from your website again. It's about obstacles, and here's the quote. I have spent my life working to uplift youth through public education and public parks and change structures of power to improve the lives as an organizer. Within these systems, when I ran into obstacles, I kept hearing, this is a state issue. That's you describing, like, your motivation for running. So can you talk about what some of those obstacles are and that you'd go to the legislature to remove potentially?
Well, I think a lot of us just, like, generate, like, in Minneapolis, I was frustrated when I was, you know, telling our lobbyists when they were going to the state that we let's double down on youth spending. Let's go all out. We have 50 rec centers in the city of Minneapolis that, you know, we could program. They're not being programmed at almost, like, only like 30% are being programmed. A lot of times they're just rooms that right now. I'm like, let's get some resources, get some caring adults. Let's get them in these places. And they're like, well, we can't do that because, you know, the money needs to go here. Whatever legislative problem that they had. And it was basically because, you know, we were basically a small municipality, like not small. We had over $200 million budget, but I just felt like there were some power constraints that were there that wouldn't allow me to do that. And then especially when everything was happening and during the Powderhorn situation, when I was reaching out to folks who were legislators, when I was reaching out to folks who were the governor asking for assistance, it seemed like they just didn't care. And I wouldn't say they didn't care. What I want to say, it felt like the problem had been, left to folks who were on the park board who were not, that wasn't what we did, right? And so I think if I was a legislator, I'd be able to help more people prevent the problems that existed in the first place.
Okay, we're good. Getting down to the end here, Londell. Do you know what the problem with DFL candidates are in Minneapolis? It's that you're all saying the same things on your website using the same buzzwords, and no one can tell the difference. How is anyone supposed to make up their mind? So here's your chance to differentiate yourself. What is different about you? Why are you better suited to this job than other candidates who are running in 62B?
What's different about me is I was going to be a politician, right? I didn't spend the last 10, 20 years of my life working in Minneapolis because one day I was going to run for office. I worked very low wage jobs, probably made about $35,000 a year. Most of the jobs I worked in Minneapolis public schools. I seen the problems that existed for folks who were low wage workers and watched them overcome some of those problems. But I'm also a kid from the streets of Milwaukee. And so some of the stuff that, our young folks are dealing with, I dealt with them, right? Overcame some of them with a lot of help from a lot of supportive folks around me. And I still think that the folks who are running right now, a lot of folks who are running, not just my race, but a lot of folks are academics, right? They go and they talk to folks who are having issues. And they say, I understand this issue. I can go help solve it. I was one of those folks who were having those issues. I'm still surrounded by folks who are having those issues. I show up to places where folks are having those conversations about what's going on in our community. I'm going to continue to show up in those places. I'm a regular person. I'm a regular dude is what I want to say. I'm not a classic politician. I'm not a classic person who, wants to say every word the right way. I know I'm going to flab my words a little bit every now and again, but I'm a regular dude. And I think regular people should be represented in our legislature. You shouldn't have to be, this polished politician who has 6 master's degrees to lead folks, because the folks in my neighborhood all don't have that. And sometimes they just want folks who look like them and have some of the same experiences that they have. So that's me. I'm a regular dude. I'm an organizer. I'm a labor organizer. I work with, folks who get up and go to work every day.
Okay. Final question that I ask everyone is recommendations. So do you have any new hobbies, any new books or movies you've seen, places you like to go? What do you do to relax? What could you recommend to listeners that would brighten their day?
Does it have to be new?
It doesn't have to be new. It could be something you have enjoyed for a very long time.
I don't, most like folks who like my close friends know this to me, but I'm a huge pro wrestling fan.
Really?
I'm literally having a WrestleMania party at my house. So I'm a huge wrestling fan. I thought I was going to be I went to school to be for broadcasting. I thought I was going to be a wrestling commentator. But anyway, I'm a huge wrestling fan. I love studying the history of wrestling, the history of like the different territories that existed throughout the state.
Oh, really?
I read books about wrestlers. I've never watched wrestling because they don't have any. There's no film of them wrestling, but just what they've done for the business and the backstage dealings and the bookers and the terminology that inside wrestlers use.
So did you see that movie? What's it called? The Iron Claw? Is that what that movie is?
I have not seen it yet, but one of my favorite wrestlers is in it. I haven't seen it yet because I haven't found time to just sit down for 3 hours to do it, but it's on my bucket list, that and Dune. So
I'm not really a wrestling fan. I'm kind of aware of the culture of it. Yeah. Kind of permeates American culture.
We're weirdos. It's okay. But
I listened to a 5-episode like 5-part series podcast about Vince McMahon. It's called, so the podcast is called Behind the Bastards, and the bastard being featured is Vince McMahon. Pretty awful person.
He's not good for the business. I mean, he probably was good at one point in time, but what happened was he monopolized the wrestling business. The wrestling used to be divided up into like 22 different fiefdoms around the country, and each territory had their own Vince McMahon. They're all equally, you know, bad guys.
Right.
But Vince's dad ruled New York, which was the biggest market in the country. And so that's how he took over the whole. He would go to each of these smaller territories, which were small, you know, I won't say small, but they were like family businesses, right? And he would pluck their top stars, and next thing you know, you have TV in your market with your top star, and next thing your show's off the air, and he's making all the money, and he put so many companies out of business that way.
I have not asked any candidate. It's occurring to me to ask this now, and we're at the end. I haven't asked any of the other candidates this, but the sports betting thing. Do you have an opinion on that? I'm kind of anti legalization. I get why prohibition is not great for certain things, but I am concerned with all the ads we have on TV about gambling, that it's going to hook people, and a lot of people are going to suffer from legalizing sports betting.
Yeah, I don't gamble per se, because I think I might like it. So I don't know that feeling you get, so I just choose not to do it. But I know folks are dealing with some of our minority communities are dealing with, you know, huge addiction issues to gambling. Right, that is just. I think we should leave all gambling proceeds go to our natives. If we're going to do that, I don't believe, you know, that's a conversation that's going to be had. But I think the revenue should go to our native Minnesotans. I think that's because that's been tradition. That's what we've been doing for the last 20 years or so. But if we're going to open up gambling, I think it should go to, I think it should go to the tribes.
Londell French is running for a Minnesota House in District 62B. This is the Wedge Live podcast. I'm your host, John Edwards.
This is a real thing.
None of you have the balls to stop this.
We're in the Wedge neighborhood right now.